The band that's playing that song is Coldplay. Coldplay is just one band among many that sings songs or talks about being lost of some sort. Has anyone ever been completely lost, like didn't know where you're at? Hold your hand up. Completely lost. So a couple of years ago, like very few men raised their hands right then just because we're so proud. Like, I've never been lost. I know exactly where I'm at all the time. So a couple of years ago, we got this harrowing phone call from Ashley's family that said, your brother, who is Pete, he grew up being called Austin. And then when he became an adult, he decided he wanted to be called Pete. And so I'm the person in the family that calls him Pete when everyone else insists on calling him Austin. I just want to respect his wishes, right? So I call him Pete. And everybody else calls him Austin. So Ashley's not here to defend herself today. So I'm telling the story about Pete, even though if she was telling the story, she'd be saying Austin. And that has nothing to do with the story. I'm just saying those things. And so we got this phone call that Pete slash Austin was lost in the woods. And so he went hiking, and when I say woods, it's not just like the patch of woods in behind the house. Like, they went hiking in the mountains outside of Seattle in Washington, which is huge national parks, and you have to be very careful. It's easy to get lost, and then if you get lost and off radar, then it's impossible to find. Like, they have people that get lost and die and never found again type stories that happen fairly often. And so for 2 to 3 days, I kid you not, 2 to 3 days, I didn't say like 2 to 3 hours. 2 to 3 days, we did not know where Pete was. He was completely lost. He was with a grown man. He was probably, I guess, in his early 20s. He was with an adult man, probably in his 40s, that he's friends with the son of the man, and they had a dog with them. So the three of them went on this hike, had limited supplies, and got totally, completely lost in the woods. Fortunately, after about 2.5 days and spending that amount of time in the deep woods, they were able to find them and to rescue them. And really, like, they brought in the rescue squads and the teams and helicopters and all those things and finally found them. But for about 2 or 3 days, we were extremely nervous and anxious about the reality that he was lost and potentially would not be found. Fortunately, he was found. Now, if you were to sit him down and to ask him about this, he's a guy. And so he would say he knew exactly where he was at and that he wasn't in that much danger. False story. He was in a lot of danger and didn't know where he was at, okay? So hopefully he's not going to watch this podcast or watch the video or listen to the podcast. But he was completely lost. But the good news is he was found. And so he was completely lost. Now, that's one type of lost. There's another type of lost where you think you know where you are, have a pretty good grasp of where you are, and then realize, like, I don't really know where I'm at. So there's that kind of loss. Like, I kind of know where I'm at, but I don't really know where I'm at. Like, I think this road goes here, or this is where I'm supposed to be, or I'm in this vicinity, but you really don't know exactly where you are. So there's that kind of loss. So there's all different types of loss, from I have no clue where I'm at to I kind of know where I'm at, but I'm still a little lost. And then there's the type of lost that will make you literally, if you watch it, throw your TV remote through the screen because you invested 5 or 6 years of your life into watching the show Lost and then realize it had no ending. Do whatever you want to do, gloss it over, pretend it had an ending, come up with all these crazy theories. In the end, it had no ending. And I wanted to strangle J.J. Abrams and say, you know how many years of my life you just wasted. Are you kidding me? And we kind of all knew it going in, like 6 episodes out. I'm like, there's no way they're bringing this thing to a close. But we lived in that denial and thought there would be a big, you can tell, like, I've got some bitterness about this whole thing, right? So there's that kind of lost. There is traveling lost, where you thought your suitcase was supposed to be at a certain place and it's not there. Like, when you go to the baggage carousel, it's not there. If you're an extensive traveler like I was, and I'm no transitioning out of all that travel, but when I was traveling a lot, I learned to carry stuff with me at all costs. Cram it into the suitcase, cram it into the overhead, use the elbow, whatever you have to do to get it in there. Make everyone angry around you for trying to cram oversized bags in the overhead, but keep it with you. That way it will not be lost. Did you know that I was involved in a lawsuit one time? Like, I had a bag that got lost, completely lost, and ended up in a different destination completely, and I tried to sue the company, but guess what? I lost my case. Oh, that's a good one. That's a good one. I lost my case. Lost is a biblical word. I wasn't really in a lawsuit. I hope you picked up on that. Like, it was all a setup. Lost is a biblical word, a very common biblical word. I love the song that we just sang that says, "Come, wanderer, there's place for you, lift your head, sinner." So lost is a biblical concept that has to do with people's spiritual condition, that they were spiritually lost and in sin, and salvation is kind of that found concept. One of the most famous songs ever written within Christian circles is Amazing Grace, and in the song Amazing Grace is the phrase, "I once was lost, but now I'm found." Very biblical concept. It is a theme that dominates Luke chapter 15, which is where we've been for the last few weeks and will be the next few weeks. So Luke 15, grab your Bible, go there if you're not there already. It is the story of three lost items. There is a lost coin, there is a lost sheep, and then what we've been focusing on is there is two lost sons. Now, many times in the past, maybe when you were talking about Luke 15, you would say there was a lost sheep, a lost coin, and a lost boy, or a lost son. But what we've learned is there were actually two lost sons. And the premise of Luke chapter 15 is that there was something that was lost, there is something that is found, and then there is this massive celebration, this massive party that takes place because what was lost has been found, and that's a reason to celebrate. Just those ideas that there's something lost and found implies that God is on a rescue mission, that he is seeking out the lost, that he is pursuing the lost. So just in the story that Jesus tells, we know that God is a seeker of the lost, and that there is rejoicing that takes place when the lost are found, that there is a celebration that takes place. And another thing that we'll pick up on in Luke 15 that you don't hear a lot when this parable is taught is there's a grand celebration that takes place in a home, that this coin and this sheep and these sons are welcomed home. So there's this concept of celebration that takes place at home. There is a redemption. There is a status of being welcomed home. And so we'll be talking about this lost, found concept. And this series is focused on the story of the lost sons, two lost sons. Now, when I use that word lost, we think about the younger son, don't we? We think about the boy that took his father's inheritance, went to the far country, his life collapses, he finds himself in the pigsty of life. Like, the younger boy fits the stereotype of what we think of when we think of the concept of lost. That he lost his way. We even use it, don't we? He lost his way. You know why we get the story of the younger son? You know why we get that he was a lost boy? Because we've been there, haven't we? We've been in that status. We've been lost. We've been in the far country. We've squandered what God gave us. We identify with the younger brother. We understand that idea of lostness. But what we've learned in this series is it wasn't just the younger brother who was lost, that it was also the older brother who is lost. The boy who stayed home. The boy who did right. And yet he is in the story equally as lost as the younger brother. Now, it's not a phrase, lost is not a phrase that we tend to associate with the older brother. So his lostness is a kind of more subtle form of lostness. But what we learn is his lostness was equally as devastating. He's equally as estranged and alienated from the father as the younger brother. And I would argue that his lostness is even more dangerous than the younger brother's because it's so subtle. So we're going to look more deeply into this concept today. We're going to define kind of this older brother lostness. What does it mean to be lost from the older brother picture? Now let's reread the story of the older brother. I think we're familiar enough at this point with the younger brother. Let's pick up in the middle of the story, starting in verse 17 of Luke 15. But when he, and the he here is the younger brother, but when the younger brother came to himself, he said, "How many of my father's hired servants have more than enough bread, but I perish here with hunger? I will arise and go to my father, and I will say to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Treat me as one of your hired servants.'" Like, we get this type of lostness. We get that the younger brother is lost here and comes to himself and is seeking repentance. And then the beautiful picture of verse 20 He arose and came to his father, but while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and felt compassion and ran and embraced him and kissed him. What a beautiful imagery of the father welcoming home this younger lost son. And the son said to him, "Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son." But the father said to his servants, "Bring quickly the best robe, put it on him, put a ring on his hand, shoes on his feet, bring the fattened calf and kill it, and let us eat and celebrate. For this my son was dead and is alive again." And here's our phrase, "He was lost and is found." And they began to celebrate. So there we see it, lost, found, celebration. And then 25, where we pick up in the story. "Now his older son was in the field, and as he came and drew near to the house, he heard music and dancing," again, celebration. "And he called one of the servants and asked what these things meant. And he said to him, 'Your brother has come, and your father has killed the fattened calf because he has received him back safe and sound.' But he was angry and refused to go in. So his father came out and entreated him, begged him. And he answered his father, 'Look, these many years I've served you, I've never disobeyed your command, yet you never gave me a young goat that I might celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours came, who has devoured your property with prostitutes, you killed the fattened calf for him.' And the father said to him, 'Son, you are always with me, and all that is mine is yours. It was fitting to celebrate and be glad, for your brother was dead and is alive.'" And here it is again. "He was lost and is found." So as we begin to unpack, what does it mean to be lost from an older brother perspective? The first thing we see that defines kind of this older brother lostness is this idea of resentment. Look back in verse 28 again. "But the older brother was angry and refused to go in." There is this deep-seated anger, this resentment, this bitterness in the older brother. Let me explain why that happened. Because the older brother had this mindset: if you live a good life, you get a good life. Live a good life, do the right thing, get a good life. God owes me a good life because. And we can fill in the blank, right? The older brother syndrome. I deserve a good life. God owes me a good life because I have whatever it is. I've been faithful to my wife. I've worked a good job. I've tried to provide for my family. I try to do the right thing. I go to church. I raise my kids right. I deserve a good life because I have blank. God owes me a good life. Now, here's the problem. When things go wrong, when suffering comes, and I've been a decent person in my mind, you know what happens? I get very angry. I either get angry with God. "God, look what I've done. How dare, why is this happening to me? Look at all I've done for you." Or I begin to resent other people. "Why is that person getting this and this is happening to me? Why is that person who lives this way being blessed when all of these things, I'm suffering these things when I've tried to do the right thing?" So when things go wrong and I've been a decent person, there's a natural resentment, a bitterness, and anger in me. Not even to mention when I fall short of my own standards. Like, well, I get furious with myself. I beat myself up. Like, I should be living this way, and then I'm not. And so my tendency is to begin to beat up myself. I deserve this. I deserve this suffering. You see, older brothers have difficulty handling suffering because it doesn't fit in their equation. If I live a good life, I get a good life. And then when things go wrong, resentment happens. You know why? Because in that case, in the case of the older brother, our morality is very kind of results driven, results motivated. Live a good life, get a good life. Suffering doesn't fit in that equation, does it? If I'm doing right, I should get a good life. And then when suffering happens, it causes bitterness, it causes anger. Elizabeth Elliot, who is a very eloquent and distinguished Christian lady who was married to a guy who named Jim Elliot, that was part of a mission team that went into a third world country where cannibals lived, and he was slaughtered there. He was murdered there by the cannibals, and eventually they all stayed and did mission work and came to Christ. But Elizabeth Elliot was a part of that, and her story is a fascinating story. But she came home and did a ton of writing. And she told this fake story. It's called an apocryphal story that's written as if it happened in the Bible. Okay, so this story I'm about to tell you, listen to me closely, did not happen in the Bible. So do not go out and tell this like it happened in the Bible, or don't go home and look for it in the Gospels. It's what we call an apocryphal story. It's not a real biblical story that we know of, but she used biblical characters to make her point. And so the story that Elizabeth Elliot tells is that Jesus says to his disciples without any explanation, "I'd like you to carry a stone," and here's the key words, "I'd like you to carry a stone for me. Carry a stone for me." So practical Peter, who's always looking to kind of, and this is part of the biblical story, practical Peter, who's always trying to maneuver and figure out the best way and get a one-up and all that. So Peter goes and finds a small pebble and says, "Well, this is easy," puts it in his pocket, and starts carrying his stone for Jesus. Well, the disciples go on their journey with Jesus, and at lunchtime, Jesus says, "All right, it's time to eat. Everyone get out your stone," and wham, Jesus turns the stone into bread. Peter's lunch was a very small lunch. So after lunch, Jesus says, "Find a stone and pick it up and carry it for me." Peter learned his lesson. Peter goes and he finds the biggest kind of small boulder that he can manage to carry. And for the next several hours, as they are following Jesus, Peter's trying to carry this small boulder, and he's thinking in his mind, "I can't wait for dinner," or "I can't wait for supper," if you're in the South. And so he's looking forward to the time where they can stop and eat dinner or supper, whatever you call it. How many supper people do we have? How many dinner people do we have? Okay, so about half and half. It's okay. You can love Jesus and call it dinner or supper. So they stop for their evening meal. See what I did there? They stop for the evening meal, dinner or supper. They stopped, and Jesus said, "All right, everyone, take your stones and throw them in the river." And they did. And they continue on their journey. And Peter is extremely confused until Jesus says to him, "Peter, don't you remember what I asked you to do? Who were you carrying the stone for? Who are you carrying the stone for? For Peter or for Jesus?" You see, results-oriented kind of self-centeredness versus obedience that's grounded in love. You see, like in the Peter story, older brothers expect their good behavior to pay off. And when it doesn't, there's resentment. There's anger. There's bitterness. Listen, if you think living decent is a way to earn a good life from God, then your life's going to be filled with resentment and anger. You know why? Because life doesn't always happen like we think it should. Life doesn't always happen as we desire. Life doesn't always happen, doesn't go the way we think it goes. So if I always feel like God owes me something because I live a decent life, a good life, if I'm always focused on others, I'm better than this person, not as bad as that person, why is this person getting this and I'm not? If that's the focus of your life, you will live a life filled with resentment, bitterness, anger. But look what else this older brother experienced in his older brother lostness. There's also this attitude, this sense of being superior, superiority. Look what he said in verse 30 again. We focused on this last week for a few minutes. I'll highlight it again. But when this is the older brother talking to the father, "But when this son of yours," right? Like not even my brother, but like this kid of yours, this son of yours, and I've made light of that. Sometimes we do that too. "This son of yours did this," or "this kid of yours did this." "When this son of yours came," by the way, if you don't know who that is, the older brother says, "this son of yours who, dad, by the way, devoured your property with prostitutes." See what he's doing here? That son of yours, you know, the one that took your money, your well-earned real estate, land that you had to sell, that you had to take a hit on your pride, this son of yours who disrespected you. And by the way, Dad, he didn't invest the money in anything wholesome or healthy. He didn't multiply the money. He wasted it on prostitutes. Dad, don't forget this son of yours. What's he really saying? Dad, check out my record of morality. I did the right thing versus your other son who is a lover of prostitutes. You know what older brothers like to do? They love to create and promote kind of the self-image of being a hardworking, moral, smart, savvy person, of being a part of kind of an elite group, that I'm not like the riffraff of society. I'm not like the people who live in that part of town. There's these feelings of superiority. I'm better than this group or this person because I don't do these things or because I do these things. Did you know that racism and classism, like I'm better than you because I'm in a different social class, you know those things are grounded in this? Kind of this self-image superiority. I'm better than you because I belong to this race. I don't live in this part of town. I don't behave in that way. I don't depend on those people for money. Racism and classism are grounded in older brother superiority. Now, this happens even in religion, doesn't it? Like, my religion is the right, God favors me because of my particularly right doctrine, or because of the worship style that we chose, or because of my ethical behavior. Like, these feelings of superiority in the religious world can be intense. And it's displayed itself how we treat and interact with those that are kind of outside our camp. I had a very wise person tell me one time, Devin, it's not always about being right. Like, you can have the right doctrine, but you can, like, isolate people who love Jesus. Now, this displays itself. I don't know if you do this. You probably don't, because it's just weird people like me that do it. But I'm involved in, you know, some online discussion sometimes about Christianity. Or different types of evangelical Christianity. Like, I'm talking about people that all love Jesus and all believe in Jesus, but we have some different particulars in our doctrine. And I can convince you in a heartbeat how right I am and have an older brother attitude the entire time. I'm superior because I believe these things and you don't. Superiority. Older brother superiority that even shows up within our beliefs. You know what the outcome of older brother superiority is? It is an unforgiving, judgmental older brother spirit. And here's what happens. Feelings of superiority make it difficult, if not impossible, to forgive. You know it's virtually impossible to forgive someone if you feel superior to them? That's why the gospel is so important. Because every day the gospel reminds me how sinful I am and how much I need Jesus. It's hard for me to forgive someone if I feel superior to them. And it's why I have to preach the gospel to myself every single day that I am a desperate sinner in need of desperate grace. My sin may be different than yours, but it is equally wrong before God. And recognition of my own sin and my own need for grace humbles me and enables me to forgive in Jesus. The only way that I can forgive you of a sin that's different than mine is to recognize my own need for salvation, my own need for a Savior. And when I am operating from the platform of I need Jesus, it enables me to forgive you of your sin, even though it's different than mine. Does that make sense? That's why we talk about grace as a way of life. Because when I have embraced the amount of grace that I have received, that's what enables me to give grace, even when your sin looks different than mine. I mean, how many times have we scratched our heads and said, I can't believe that person got involved in that. I would never do that. You may not, but the sin that you're involved in is equally as sinful as that sin. Amen. Equally in need of grace. The gospel reminds me, I'm not superior. I am humble before the cross. And it's through the gospel that I'm able to forgive and be forgiven. The older brother could not recognize his own self-centeredness, and therefore he could not forgive his younger brother. Let's talk about another one, 29. There's a level of insecurity going on here. The younger brother says to his father, look, these many years I have served you, and I've never disobeyed your command. Yet you never gave me a goat that I might celebrate with my friends. Older brother lostness is often defined by insecurity, an insecurity of the father's love. You never threw me a party. You never gave me a young goat. I was never able to celebrate with my buddies. You see the pouting that's going on. You see, moral-driven lostness, which is what we're talking about, is never confident that I have been good enough for the father. There's always the insecurity. Have I done enough? Have I been good enough? What about this that's going on in my life? And so when something goes wrong in my life, or people criticize me, or I sin repeatedly, I question whether it's because I'm good enough or living right in some area of my life. So I live life constantly questioning whether I'm good enough, primarily because I know me. I know what's in my heart. I know my own sinfulness. And so my tendency is to live life in this insecurity, this fear. Have I done enough? Have I done the right thing? And it creates all kinds of havoc. Let me talk about one more, and we'll kind of transition to the end of the story. There's also one, I think I got this backwards in the notes, in the slides. You probably wouldn't even have noticed if I hadn't said it. That's how good our screen people are. Not only this feeling of insecurity, but there's this kind of fear-driven, fear-motivated obedience or compliance to the father's rules. Look back in 29 again. He answered his father, many years I have served you, and I have never disobeyed your command. You know this word served can actually be translated, I have slaved for you. I have been your slave. Fear. Driven, obedience, compliance, morality. All these years, I've slaved for you. Now, let's be really honest here. Like faithfulness, being faithful to a commitment involves duty at times, right? It's my obligation to do it. Maybe there's no clearer place this is displayed than in marriage. Like, you're not always faithful to your spouse because you're so deeply in love with them in the moment. Sometimes you are faithful to them because you made a commitment to them, and it is out of duty that you are faithful to them. It's okay at times to be doing things out of duty. That's what keeps you committed and keeps you faithful. So faithfulness to a commitment always involves some level of duty. Sometimes I just do it because I'm supposed to do it. But if you live life very long in that kind of realm of duty, if duty is the primary or kind of the underlying motive, eventually it becomes not duty but drudgery. Like, I'm doing it and I'm miserable doing it. I regret doing it. There's kind of this sheer drudgery that you live life with. So here's the question. Was the older brother responsible to stay home? Was it a responsible thing to do to stay and be faithful to his father and faithful to his commitment? Yes. Was he an obedient son that did what he was supposed to do? Yes. Should he be applauded for doing good and not running to the far country and all those things? Yes. He was faithful. He was dutiful. He was obedient. Yes, yes, yes. But what the story shows us is that his obedience was slavish. It was joyless. It was fear-driven. Like, we're a country that has a history of slavery. And if you read anything about that time in our nation's history, slaves were not compelled out of goodness and because they wanted to do it and because they were treated fairly. Slaves work out of fear, the fear of consequences. Now, let me illustrate this for you in a way you'll understand it. Is telling the truth right? Is it the right thing to do to tell the truth? Yeah. Absolutely. Is why you tell the truth important? Not just telling the truth, but is the why, the motive behind telling the truth important? See, so here's the difference. I can tell the truth out of a motive of the fear of getting caught. I don't want to get caught being dishonest. Or maybe I'll be perceived as being a dishonest person if I don't tell the truth. like those are motives, and those are motives that can lead you to do the right thing at times. But I can tell you this. If my reason for always telling the truth is only driven by a fear of getting caught being dishonest or being perceived as a dishonest person, you know what's going to happen when there comes a situation where it's more inconvenient for me to tell the truth than not? I'm going to be dishonest. Because truth is just a matter of convenience. And when the time comes where it's inconvenient to tell the truth, I'm going to default toward dishonesty and not truth. I'm going to tell a lie when it's advantageous to me. Or if telling the truth will cost me dearly, I may not tell the truth if my motives aren't pure. Like if my job's on the line, if I refuse to tell the truth, like that's when it gets real, right? That's when my motives really come out. Am I telling the truth because it's to my advantage? Am I telling the truth because I don't want to be perceived as an honest or dishonest person? You see, there's a difference in telling the truth for slavish reasons and telling the truth because I love God and I love the truth. And I want to tell the truth regardless of the consequences. Honesty for reasons of fear does not get to the root of the problem. The problem is the human heart, which is naturally self-centered. Here's the danger. Fear-driven morality, fear-driven, in this case, telling the truth, actually strengthens the older brother's lostness because ultimately I'm only being moral for my benefit, selfish reasons. And this is kind of hard to wrap our minds around, but I hope you can get it. Did you know you can do selfless things for selfish reasons? I can feed the poor for all the wrong reasons. I can give money to people for all the wrong reasons. I can help others. I can be charitable. I mean, we can go down the list of good moral things you can do for all the wrong reasons, for my own benefit at the end of the day. That's what's happening with the older brother. He stayed home. He did right. He obeyed the father for all the wrong reasons. And that's why he was as lost as the younger brother. I heard the story of a gardener who lived in a kingdom that grew the largest carrot he had ever grown. Now, I don't know why a carrot is the symbol in the story, but it is, so I'm going to roll with it. The gardener grows this large carrot, and he takes it to the king. He says, man, this carrot is so huge and humongous, like I need to like give this to someone. And so he takes it to the king and is brought before the king, this you know, humble gardener in the kingdom. And he says, king, I have grown the largest carrot I have ever grown. And to show my admiration of you and my devotion to you and my love for you, I want you to have the carrot. And the king's like, this is outstanding. Like, thank you so much for the token of appreciation. Here's what I'm going to do. I've got this fertile piece of land right beside the palace. And because you've shown your faithfulness and devotion, I want you to live there. I want you to garden there. I want you to grow vegetables there. I want that to be your spot. And the farmer's like, wow, this is overwhelming. I didn't intend for that. I just wanted to show my devotion to you. In the meantime, there's a nobleman that's listening in on all this. And he has a brilliant idea. He goes home because he was a person that raised horses. And he finds his biggest and strongest and most beautiful black stallion. And he leads it into the palace the next day. And he brings it before the king. And he says, I am a raiser of horses. I don't even know what that title is. But I'm a person who raises horses. And this is my biggest, strongest steed. This is my black stallion. And I want to give it to you as a gift to show my devotion to you. And the king says, thank you for the gift, you are dismissed. You know why? Because he discerned the nobleman's heart. And the nobleman is confused. And here's what the king says to the nobleman. The gardener was giving me the carrot, but you were giving yourself the horse. You following? The gardener, the king says, was giving me the carrot. His motive was to show his love and devotion to me. But you are giving yourself the horse because ultimately the intention was, what will I get by giving my horse to the king? You see, underneath the act of selflessness is actually selfishness. Getting what we want through what appears to be kind and charitable and generous acts. Here's the problem with that, and I have lived this. The problem with fear-driven compliance and selflessness, the problem is eventually it blows up. It blows up. It erupts. Because at the foundation of the selflessness is the sinfulness of my own heart and my own selfish heart. And moral living, doing right just for selfish reasons, is exhausting. You can never do enough. You can never measure up. You can never feel like you've accomplished enough. And so you try to do more and more and more. It is checklist living. Did I read my Bible today? Did I pray today? Did I give today? Was I kind today? And the list goes on, and it becomes exhausting because I'm ultimately in it for myself. You know why we hear so many stories today of moral leaders having dramatic falls or living secret lives of sin? Is because fear-driven compliance, fear-driven obedience will eventually cause you to either rebel against the authority, which is what the younger brother did, give me my stuff, I'm going to the far country, or it will cause you to live a life of secret slavish obedience. And eventually, it'll blow up. It will erupt. Because it's exhausting. And you'll destroy your life in the process. Fear-driven compliance. Resentment. Superiority. Fear-driven obedience. Insecurity of the Father's love. Man, older brother, lostness looks and sounds messy, doesn't it? And it is. You know what the good news is? The Father comes out into the field and invites the older brother to the table. You know what the table symbolizes in this story? Freedom, humility, grace-driven obedience out of love for the Father, the security that comes with being a part of the Father's home. The Father invites us into this type of relationship with Him, not a relationship driven by resentment and superiority and fear-driven compliance and insecurity. Have I been enough, done enough, been good enough? Not the insecurity that comes with older brother lostness. He invites us into this relationship that is grounded in grace and freedom and humility and love for the Father and security in the Father's home. The Father invites us to the table. So here's my question for you as we end this message today. Who needs to hear this message of older brother lostness? Well, a couple of easy ones, right? One, older brothers. I told you that churches tend to be filled with older brothers instead of younger brothers. The original audience of Jesus, this story was told to the younger brothers, like they were the reason Jesus is telling this story. So older brothers need to hear it. And the reason that older brothers, including you and I, need to hear it is because we fail to recognize our need for Jesus. We talked about that last week, that older brothers often do not comprehend or understand their condition. See, you can be sick and not realize you're sick or not acknowledge you're sick or not even feel like you're sick and fail to go to the doctor. And you know where that ends? Death. A person can be sick and not recognize it, see it, feel it, know it, and can end up dying. That's older brother lostness. Jesus said, I didn't come for the healthy, I came for the sick. And if you don't recognize your sickness, that you are a sinner in need of Jesus, then you will die lost. Older brothers need to hear. You know who else needs to hear this message? Younger brothers. You know why younger brothers, particularly in our culture, need to hear this message? Because do you know why many younger brothers picked up their bags and walked away from the Father's house? Because they got sick of older brothers in the house. You know why so many people walk away from church? You know why so many go and flee to the younger, to the far country and waste their lives? If you talk to them, a lot of the times the reason is because they were sick of older brother mentality in the church. Anyone know what I'm talking about? Anyone been where I'm talking about? They walked away because of older brother attitudes. They are tired of attitudes of resentment and bitterness and superiority and fear-driven obedience. And guess what? They're right. They're right. Churches are filled with older brother mentalities. They are right at some level. And that's why the answer is the gospel. That's why we point people to the gospel, because the gospel calls us away from the immorality of the younger brother, and it condemns the moral-based lostness of the older brother as well. If you're in a younger brother situation today, let me tell you, older brotherness and Christianity are not the same thing. Don't confuse them. Our faith is driven by grace. And younger brother is not a better option, is it? Like wasting your life and squandering it and living that life. We know if we've been there, that's not a better alternative. But so many have walked away from the church because of older brother mentalities. And it's why as a church we cannot point people to us. We cannot point people to the church as an institution. We have to point people to Jesus, who invites both older brothers and younger brothers to the Father's table. Both need the gospel. Amen. Younger brothers need to hear. We've blown it at times. Yes, we've been older brothers. Yes, we have displayed attitudes of superiority and judgmentalism when we should have displayed attitudes of grace and love and forgiveness and the call to Jesus. Yes, we have stood back and pointed our fingers and looked down our noses at people who are different than us. We have looked down our noses whose people's sins were different than ours when we should have pointed people to the gospel. We've done that. Yes. But we invite younger brothers back and we say, don't confuse the church with older brotherism. And then we call on City Church to be an environment, a place that invites both people. Younger brothers, older brothers to the table. And then here's the last group that needs to hear. Genuine followers. Who are older brother-ish. That's me. That's you. You see, if we do not grasp the gospel fully and regularly and consistently, we are drawn toward attitudes of condemnation and bitterness and anger and superiority. Christians, I mean, we don't have to look very long to know this. Christians have a tendency to live life with this kind of undercurrent of anger and holding grudges and looking down on people of other races and religions. We have this tendency to live life with no joy. We live life with deep insecurities. Are we good enough for God? We are often overcritical. We are often show no mercy. But again, younger brother living is not a better option. It's why we must be called to the gospel. I said at the very beginning, the entire paradigm of Luke 15 is lost, found, celebrate. That's a beautiful picture. God pursues the lost. He finds them. Let's celebrate. Older brother Christianity is a sad picture of that paradigm. Lost, found, rescued. So, what's the answer? God exposes both sons as equally lost. He redefines lostness. So, what's the solution? Next week, we will discover Jesus deliberately left someone out of this story. And he did it so that we would look for him. And by finding him, we will find our way home.